Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosefan, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law here in sunny Santa Clara, California. My guest today on the podcast is Josh King, Vice President for Business Development and General Counsel at Avvo Incorporated. We live in an era of disruption. We have seen the sale of books and music be disrupted by Amazon and iTunes. We've seen the disruption in the provision of taxi cabs in hotels through the development of Uber and Airbnb. And now perhaps we're seeing a disruption in the market for the provision of legal services. There have been a number of technologically based innovations in this area, and maybe first among them, certainly prominent among them, is Avvo Incorporated. So we're going to be discussing Avvo's business model today, and I'm thrilled to have Josh King on the line with us to discuss it. Josh, thanks so much for being a guest on the podcast.
Oh, you bet, David. Thanks for having me.
So Josh, tell us, what is Avvo? How does it work? And how did it come to be as a going concern?
So Avvo is, first and foremost, it's a legal directory, and that's really what it started as. But it started a little bit differently than any other legal directory in that it was founded back in 2006 and launched in 2007. And it was an idea that that Mark Britton had. Mark is our founder. He is still our CEO, runs the business, and he was the first general counsel at Expedia. And he had the idea that even as an experienced lawyer, he was continuously having people ask him about lawyers they should hire for various problems. And as you know, those of us who are lawyers know, even if we know a lot of lawyers, we oftentimes can't help people out because we don't know someone in the right geography, in the right practice area, whatever the case may be. And so the idea of Avvo was to create a legal directory that was first and foremost consumer-focused on solving that problem for consumers of how to find and how to evaluate lawyers. And so what really made it different from the get-go was that we created profiles of every lawyer we could find records for, which as of now includes just about every lawyer in the country. We create those profiles unilaterally. We use the state bar licensing and disciplinary records. We provide a forum where clients can leave feedback. And then we also use our own algorithm that we've built with input from hundreds of lawyers and lots of legal academics and mathematicians and the like to essentially provide an editorial rating of lawyers. And that's the Avvo rating. It's on a 1 to 10 scale. And it's all in service of the idea of providing a level of transparency and evaluation that consumers haven't had before when they're looking to hire a lawyer.
Okay. And so in terms of its directory aspects, Avvo you go onto Avvo and you can... You're searching for a lawyer in your region that practices in an area of law where you are having some legal difficulty. You don't know a lot of lawyers. Even the lawyers you know don't know lawyers outside of their narrow practice area. So you get online, you put in your location, you put in the type of or you select the practice area, and up comes a list of lawyers in that area that have this ranking that Avvo's algorithm has provided. Is that the essence of it?
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. And you can also search by name, and so that's important, particularly for lawyers who operate on more referral-based practices. You can search by name on Avvo or on Google, and you will find the profile of that lawyer, and you can look up their background, find out how long they've been licensed, whether they've been disciplined.
Now, obviously, I expect some of your answers to be, I can't answer that because it's proprietary, but can you explain something about the business model here, about how is this, why hasn't this happened in the past, and how is this, what's the business model from Avvo's perspective? How are you able to make this work as a business for yourselves?
Well, the directory is also, and we can talk a little bit about some of the other products we have, but we also have a lot of legal information on the site. And we have a question and answer forum where consumers can ask questions and get answers from lawyers. All of this and that in combination with the directory, which again is not your traditional sort of pay-to-play lawyer-focused directory, but is really a comprehensive, credible consumer-focused directory. Our bet was that that would be really useful to consumers and they would find it appealing. And so that would create enough interest in the site that we could sell advertising to lawyers. And that's really worked out. We've become far and away the largest and most heavily trafficked legal directory in the United States. We have thousands and thousands of lawyers who pay to advertise on the site. And it works in a model similar to Google in that around our content, you will see a limited number of sponsored listings that are purchased by lawyers.
Okay, so you if you go onto the directory, you search for your problem in your area, or even if you're searching for a lawyer by name, up will come that information that you've searched for, but you'll also see advertisements from other lawyers that work in that area, or you know, that your search terms have called up their ads that they've paid Avvo to be, you know, to have that ad space. And but lawyers don't have to pay to become a part of the directory. In fact, they're in the directory whether they know it or not. I was quite surprised as I was preparing for this conversation to find that I'm in Avvo's directory, that I have an Avvo page, which was news to me, you know. So I must say that initially I was surprised by that and made uncomfortable by it, and I think that some of the criticism of Avvo circulates around that issue, that in a sense my identity, if you will, as a professional has been commodified by Avvo, in that Avvo has a page on me but I don't have a relationship with Avvo, and that troubled me until I started, but then honestly, on the last couple of days, I thought, well, you know, I'm a member of the Massachusetts Bar, and my information's on the Massachusetts Bar website, and it's a matter of public record, the fact that I'm a lawyer, and I'm happy to say I have no disciplinary actions against me. And so, you know, what really would be the source of my objection to Avvo taking that otherwise publicly available information and repackaging on their website in a way that they think is useful to consumers?
Yeah, and you've kind of and I thank you for that, David. You've kind of come full circle on the kind of conversations that I've had with lawyers over the years, where I have to have the second half of that conversation with them, because I think it's just a little different than what lawyers are used to. I think that products that have traditionally been marketed to lawyers have been very lawyer-centric, and directories that have been marketed to lawyers have been very lawyer-centric. And if you don't want to be in it, you're not going to be in it. And we've sort of taken the opposite approach, where we want to provide as much transparency to consumers as possible. And that shouldn't be a problem, because lawyers are part of it. You know, it's a professional occupation. It's important information for consumers to have. I will note that we do, although we don't remove the profiles from Avvo, we have a number of things we can do to indicate that people aren't practicing law. We have ways of making sure that home addresses or phone numbers are removed, and so that they're not published. So we're always happy to sort of control things like that within the profiles. But I think that consumer centrism and posting it without waiting to ask permission from the lawyers is a little bit different than the traditional expectations that lawyers have.
Another criticism that I have read about Avvo in connection with the directory function, and this criticism can be launched at a number of consumer-oriented you know, review sites or search engines, but that's no reason not to ask the question or to have a good answer for it. And that is the fairness of the consumer reviews or client reviews of the lawyers that get incorporated into these profile listings and presumably incorporated in some sense into the algorithm that Avvo deploys to come up with a ranking for the lawyer. So you might have somebody with a grudge against a lawyer or a client who was dissatisfied but doesn't really have a bona fide beef against a lawyer, nevertheless authoring very negative reviews of the lawyer that then get impounded into their profile on Avvo. What do you do, if anything, to regulate the fairness of that process?
Yeah, first of all, consumer reviews of products and services are incredibly and increasingly important. They've become one of the most, the primarily trusted sources of information about product and service purchase decisions. And so we're providing something that consumer feedback, and particularly the feedback we get directly, tells us very strongly is very, very important. Now, one of the issues with reputational ecosystems and systems of client reviews is that they can run the gamut in terms of how open they are, what the possibilities are for fraud. And I think it can be a struggle for lawyers sometimes to accept or understand the concept that you have a system like this. It's not going to be completely immune from fraud. It's not going to be perfect. But in our particular case, I mean, we think we've done a lot of things to make our system more sophisticated than most. We have a system of community guidelines that we use. Unlike most review sites, we actually moderate all of our reviews before they're posted. So we have a queue where people actually read all of the reviews and don't post the ones that don't meet our guidelines. And about a third of the reviews that are left on Avvo don't ever see the light of day because they don't meet our guidelines for any number of reasons. And then beyond that, we have an escalation process that we'll go through where a review can get a second look or even a reaffirmation from the reviewer in order to ultimately stay up. But, what we're trying to do at the end of the day is operate a system that's really useful and credible and relatively open for consumers while also balancing and respecting the reputational interests of lawyers.
It is a difficult balancing act, I think, because one criticism may be that they're just letting anything in completely unvetted with respect to the to client assessment or consumer comments about a lawyer, that you're just letting anything in. But then on the other side, the criticism would be that you're exercising too heavy a hand of editing, and that you're keeping out information that might be useful to consumers, or keeping out information that might be, privileging Avvo's own perspective on the lawyer or on the practice of law. And some of the comments that I read, as I was doing my due diligence in preparation for this conversation, which just basically involved Googling Avvo and kind of clicking around for a while and reading things, was people saying that they had written reviews of lawyers that never made it to the site. And so you say that that's part of the process, but what would some of the reasons be for not admitting consumer comments into the site or as part of the algorithm?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's one of the functions that I have at Avvo is I oversee our customer care team, and certainly I have inquiries that escalate to me from both sides, both from lawyers who are appalled that we've posted a particular review, and from consumers who are appalled that we didn't post a particular review, and that's where the balancing comes in. I would say most typically that the types of consumer reviews that don't get posted are ones where they either don't indicate within the body of the review that they were actually a client, or ones where they are so over the top with ad hominem attacks and bad language that we don't post it. We give people a fair bit of room for hyperbole and even a little bit of name calling, but there's a line that we're going to draw on that. And I would say there's also a persistent subset of situations where we, even though the consumer pays the attorney's fees, we don't allow reviews. And those are those situations where an attorney, where the consumer pays, but they're not really being represented by the attorney. So think of like a guardian ad litem situation.
A third-party payer type situation.
Yeah, exactly. And that that can be kind of a hard thing for consumers to understand sometimes, you know, when they want to leave a negative review because the decision went against them.
Mm-hmm. And so there's also this function of the directory aspect where you can, I guess this is part of the business model as well, that you can pay Avvo to, if you're a lawyer, you're automatically listed in the directory, but if you pay Avvo a certain fee, then you kind of get a more elaborate directory listing. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's our enhanced profile.
Mm-hmm. But that does that, do you get bumped in the search engine if you're part of that enhanced program?
No, it doesn't change where you would appear within our organic search results. It simply it does things like gives you more customization on your profile. It gives you better analytics about who's been looking at your profile and contacting you. Gives you it removes any competitive ads from your profile. Those are the primary benefits.
Right. Well, this is just one aspect of the business. But even this, I think, is quite disruptive or quite innovative just in the whole history of lawyering in our culture. I think you're quite right to describe the process of finding a lawyer, of finding out what kind of legal services are available, how much they cost, how do you get in touch with one, how do you know whether one's a good one or not, you know, has been particularly opaque, and the profession has to recognize that, and maybe that in some sense the profession has benefited from that opacity, and in some ways maybe the profession has hamstrung itself. So maybe we can return to that, but it's not the only service that that Avvo offers, and perhaps the most, if I can say, I don't know how much you like these comparisons, but if I could say that directory function is sort of like Yelp, the more innovative and perhaps controversial is the advisor function that Avvo has, which I might compare to Uber. It's sort of the Uber of lawyering. I don't know if you like that comparison, but in any event, can you describe the advisor function so we can get into a conversation about that?
Sure, and those comparisons are perfectly fair, and I mean, frankly, we've heard those comparisons around our own offices. Those are companies that we share some investors with. So it's certainly part of an ecosystem that we pay attention and think about in terms of how consumers access services. The advisor function, it's a really new product for us. It's something we've been testing out in a variety of different iterations over the last year and have really only launched in earnest in the last few months. But it's the first step in what we see as potentially opening up a big latent market for legal services. All of our research shows, and I know that there's a lot of other research out there, that consumers and small businesses just don't access legal services like they should. And a big part of that is that the market is so opaque. I mean, if you think about pretty much any category of goods or services you can shop for, you can research, shop for it, and buy it online, except for non-elective healthcare and legal services. And that's really what we're trying to solve for with Advisor. So what Advisor does is it's a pretty simple product. You can either access it through this site or through our mobile app, but you pick your area of practice and your geography, and it connects you with a lawyer within 15 minutes, oftentimes in under a minute, for a $39 consultation for 15 minutes. So it's essentially a packaged legal service in the form of a brief consultation with a lawyer to talk through legal issues.
So it's fascinating. So if I can just reiterate, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's an app on your phone, or you can do it online, and you again go to the legal area that you have a question about, whether it's landlord-tenant, family law, criminal law, real estate law, and you say, I need a lawyer. You put your question out there. Do you put the question out there initially, or you just say, this is the area I have a question about?
Yeah, so the way we put it out there is we have our participating lawyers, who are lawyers who told us they want to participate in this program, and we send it out to whoever's within that geography in that practice area, and the first participating lawyer to pick it up is the one to make that phone call. But we just simply tell them there's an inquiry in this practice area in your geography.
In the practice area, so you're not posing the question more specifically, just that in this practice area, there's an issue, and then it gets, AVO will then ping or send out a notification to all the lawyers that are signed up with AVO in that region, and literally the first one to reply gets the call, right?
Yep.
And then they call the person who has asked for help, and they have a phone consultation, and it costs the consumer $39.
That's right. And they can, and on that phone conversation, they can, we've recently added functionality where they can share documents so that the consumer can snap a photo of a contract or a ticket or the like and shoot it through the app to the attorney so they can look at it while they're having that conversation.
So this is, I think, potentially very exciting, very innovative, and I think your firm is to be complimented on the innovation itself, and not to say, and I mean that sincerely, that's not to say there aren't some serious questions that come to mind that I want us to discuss, but so you know you get the idea. One could, how often has somebody have you, if you're listening to this, and you're sitting around with your roommates, you know, in an apartment, and going on maybe from with your landlord, and how often have you said to yourself, I wonder if this is legal, or is there anything we could do about this? And you just keep saying that, you know, week after week, month after month, every time the problem happens, whatever it is, or even much more seriously in a family law situation where you're in a custody dispute and this person you share custody with, the problem, you know, a problem emerges, it keeps coming up, you don't know whether it's lawful or your rights are being violated, but you don't call your lawyer because you haven't spoken to them in years anyway, and it might cost you $200 to even get the conversation going or a visit to their office. Instead, you launch the app on your iPhone or your Samsung or whatever it is, and boom, in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, you've got a lawyer on the horn. You're having a conversation, costs you $39, you're in and you're out, and you've had some lawyering in a way that was just otherwise in the whole history of humanity not available, right? So that's very exciting. Now there are some questions about the ethics of the of this service from a regulatory perspective. The legal profession is a very heavily regulated profession historically, for good or for ill. And there are some questions about whether this this advisor function that AVO is running runs afoul of some of those central prohibitions. I'll throw one out there that's of major concern, and maybe you, who have been much more intimately involved in this, can take us through some of the others. A principal prohibition in the practice of law is the regulation against fee splitting. Rule 5.4 of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct says a lawyer or a law firm shall not share legal fees with a non-lawyer. And as I read the AVO site, when you get the consumer pays the $39, and 10 of that goes to AVO, and if my math is right, 29 of it goes to the lawyer at the end of that phone conversation. Now, the prohibition against fee splitting, its best justification, I think, historically from a regulation of the profession perspective, is that the purpose of the fee splitting prohibition is to keep non-lawyers from interfering in the lawyer-client relationship and to keep non-lawyers adversely affecting the nature of that relationship or forcing non-legal concerns into the management of that relationship. The worst that can be said for it is that it has serves as a monopolistic barrier to entry in the provision of legal services, which has undermined the consumer interest in favor of lawyers, in favor of a professional interest. But regardless of what justifications there have been or the legitimacy of the rule against fee splitting, can you give us your response to the allegation that AVO's advisor service violates the prohibition against fee splitting?
Sure. And you're right. I mean, the reason to have a rule against fee splitting is to protect the professional independence of the lawyer. Now, I'll say that we've, and myself specifically, have put quite a bit of thought into the design of the advisor product and trying to make sure not only that it complies with the ethics rules, but that it complies in a way that is going to make most participants comfortable with it. And so when it comes to fee splitting, we've actually been fairly conservative. I actually think the advisor product could work as you've described it, where we did in fact split the fee, because such a split would not in any way interfere with the professional independence of a lawyer. It would no more interfere with professional independence than it would than the fee split that occurs when a lawyer accepts a credit card, for example. But that said, we actually designed the product so that it's a little more conservative than that. The lawyer actually gets the whole $39, so they get the entire fee from the client, and then after the fact, we charge the lawyer a marketing fee for participating in the advisor program.
Okay, so and that's the $10 per call that they take. So you characterize that as a marketing fee, and conceptually, I have to say that I think fee splitting is a hard one. It doesn't always stand up to logical inquiry, because obviously lawyers are allowed to split fees with secretaries, you know, lawyers are allowed to advertise. They have a constitutionally protected right to engage in commercial speech, and lawyers are allowed to pay advertisers or a marketing firm to come up with an ad with a campaign strategy for them. And obviously, where's that money coming from that they're paying the advertisers? Well, it's coming from client fees. So in what sense is that not fee splitting, you know? But I think that traditionally, we sort of have the idea that the lawyer is kind of in control and is hiring up the secretary, is hiring up the marketer, and giving them a portion of the fee, whereas here it feels a little more like AVO is in charge or is in control and is really apportioning a lawyer a piece of the fee. And that it is a formal distinction to call this a marketing fee rather than just a straight fee split. Can you respond to that, or do you feel you already have? Maybe you have.
Well, yeah, I mean, whether it's a formal distinction or not, I think the most important thing is to look at the purpose of the rule, which is, like all the, virtually everything within the rules of professional conduct is designed to protect consumers and clients. And when you have a situation where, whether it's formulaic or fee split or not, if there's no chance of it interfering with the lawyer's independent professional judgment and thus, you know, negatively impacting the client, then we really shouldn't worry about it. And I think, you know, when I was doing my research on this and putting it together, one of the things I came across was that something like 9 or 10 states in the ABA have all issued ethics opinions on Groupon, of all things. And at least half of them sort of pretty briefly dispensed with the fee split issue, which is frankly looms larger in the Groupon context, because you're dealing with a non-legal entity and it takes something like half the fee, and there's a whole thing on how the timing works out and the like, and basically decided that it was not a problem right out of the gate, simply because there's just no chance of it interfering with the lawyer's independent professional judgment. But that said, I mean, we've tried to structure it in a way that's a little more conservative than that.
Yeah, you know, I often have in the past, before Avvo came along, introduced the fee splitting rule to my legal ethics classes by asking them why you don't see, when you walk into Walmart or Target, why don't you see an aisle marked legal services? You know, and you walk down that aisle and have a series of cubbies or a series of of cubbies with little walls between them, with lawyers sitting in the cubbies offering legal services that, you know, Walmart seems to be able to offer every other kind of service. And surely Walmart would be able to offer legal services more cheaply than is the conventional model of the standalone law office, the small law partnership, or even the large legal corporation. Surely Walmart would be able to lower the cost of the provision of that service and thus lower prices to consumers. Why don't you see, surely there would be a market for Walmart legal services. Why don't you see it? The reason is not because Walmart doesn't want to sell it. Surely Walmart would be very eager to get at some of the profits that are available in the legal market. The reason Walmart doesn't offer it is because the profession prohibits lawyers from entering into that kind of practice. The profession prohibits lawyers from practicing law. Another element of Rule 5.4, a more technical specification of the rule, is forbids lawyers from practicing law in a firm or in a corporation, any part of which is owned by a non-lawyer. Right? So Walmart's owned by millions of shareholders, thus violates the prohibition against lawyers fee splitting or practicing law with non-lawyers. But Avvo so that prohibition against fee splitting or organizing with non-lawyers has been a matter of professional regulation more than it has been a matter of broader social or economic regulation. I think Avvo has perhaps found a way to disrupt the application of that rule that bypasses the kind of bricks and mortar hypothetical that I've been using for many years. So have you had bar associations coming after you for violating fee splitting, or is this only something that legal ethicists are worrying about?
Hopefully, simply legal ethicists and maybe the occasional lawyer here and there. We generally have pretty good relations with the bar associations, and there's a number of them that that I've, you know, over the years have gotten to know some of the folks in the ethics and disciplinary groups. I've had a couple of conversations with the bar associations, including a couple that were more sort of preemptive to reach out and let them know what we were doing. But I can't say I've had anyone who's looked at it and said, geez, this strikes me as being fundamentally problematic.
And have you had lawyers who are resentful of service or resentful of the Avvo's disruption of the traditional ways of practicing law? Have they been filing complaints in bar associations against Avvo for violation of this or other rules?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've certainly fielded lots of complaints from lawyers over the years about all sorts of things Avvo does, but it's principally around the stuff we talked about at the beginning, the rating, the profile without their permission, the client reviews. I have not seen a single complaint, actually, about Advisor. I have fielded a number of inquiries from lawyers who are concerned about a variety of ethics issues, including the fee splitting issue. But they've actually all been more in the context of, gee, this looks kind of interesting, but I have this worry. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all if, you know, in the months to come, we see some of those complaints from people who feel like this is something either they don't want to participate in or they can't participate in, and they feel like it's affecting their business. But that hasn't materialized yet.
Well, another question about Advisor that emerges is this, at some level, very attractive $39 for a 15-minute consultation with a lawyer, I mean, you might drop $39 on bad takeout, you know, bad Chinese food or Italian food or whatever it is, right? So you might waste $39 in a lot of places, okay? But can you expect to get valuable legal advice for $39 or for any fee in 15 minutes? Is that a plausible, maybe it's a plausible business model. Is it a plausible model for the ethical, competent provision of a reasonable legal service, 15 minutes of consultation for $39?
Absolutely. And this is one where, you know, we've a lot of people wrote about Advisor and probably wrote things similar to that, you know, raising that issue. There's no question that there's all sorts of legal problems that cannot be adequately addressed in 15 minutes. There's no question about that at all. But like you alluded to earlier, there's all sorts of things where you can get you can go a long way. I mean, you can get a lot of great help inside of 15 minutes or even a lot less just by getting some very basic legal questions answered. I actually dog-fooded the product a couple times as we were testing it out, and I made live calls on it to get answers to some, you know, we're a growing business, and we sometimes have immigration issues, and so I had some very esoteric immigration law questions, and I used the service for that. One time I got a call back in less than 15 seconds, and I got the answers I needed, and I don't think I ever spent more than 6 or 7 minutes on a call. But again, these were, you know, these were direct focused questions. And I think there's a lot of things that, that people have questions about that are pretty straightforward. They're very focused. They're very to the point, but it's something where the application or just a little bit of legal help, would go a long way. And it's also the case that I think a lot of lawyers can evaluate in 15 minutes whether something requires more help. And that's one where lawyers are free to continue the call as long as they want. And they can certainly, you know, the system doesn't cut them off after 15 minutes. And they're certainly free to, and we've gotten feedback from lawyers that it's actually working out this way, they can certainly turn it into an ongoing representation where they can have the, they essentially use this as their initial meeting, and then they have the person contact them to undertake a more, full-blown representation.
And so that might be more satisfying from a competence and diligence perspective with respect to the lawyer's obligation to provide competent and diligent service. But does it raise another ethical problem with respect to the consumer who's walking into it thinking, for $39, I'm going to be able to get my legal help here, but now I've made the phone call, and what I've actually gotten is... is this lawyer's used the occasion to recruit me or solicit me for a much more elaborate representation?
Yeah, and that's, you know, I'll tell you, that's something that went to a lot of our early discussions around this product and the difference between a paid consultation and a free consultation. Mm-hmm. And there was a bit of a debate about, you know, well, why would people pay for a consultation if they can get a free consultation? And the thinking was there's actually a real difference between a free consultation and a paid consultation. And outside of the product defect and personal injury, a free consultation is essentially a sales pitch. Mm-hmm. And so we in our training materials and our ongoing care for this for the lawyer participants in this product, we really try to stress that they cannot treat this call the way they would treat a free consultation. It's not designed to be a sales pitch for their practice. It's designed to answer whatever legal questions that person may have if they can be answered in 15 minutes. And if that turns into something more, great. But it has to turn into something more based on, traditional inbound marketing principles, that you're actually communicating your competence and your know-how and your empathy and your approach, and thus they're going to want to continue with you. And not just giving them a sales pitch. And we plan to kick people out of the program, lawyer participants, if they're, if they have repeated complaints about them using this as what is effectively a free consultation.
So you, I mean, you're not heaven forfend, you're not monitoring the phone call, but rather would rely on consumer complaints with respect to that practice.
Exactly. Yeah, we're certainly not going to monitor the phone calls, but we are absolutely going to encourage consumers to leave feedback about their review session. And if we start seeing that kind of pattern where they're like, geez, you know, this guy was just trying to sell me on their services the whole time, that's the sort of thing we don't want to see the participants doing.
Now, suppose a client calls up or a customer calls up on Advisor and the lawyer has a consultation with them and explains this is not the kind of question that can be answered in 15 minutes. I invite you to call my office, or here's my email, or now you've got my number because I called you back. We can set something up. I'd be happy to have a more elaborate conversation with you, but this is not the kind of thing that can happen in 15 minutes. What happens then to the $39?
Well, the $39 isn't actually charged until the consultation is complete. Mm-hmm. And there's also 100% money back guarantee. So in a case like that, the fee isn't actually going to be charged to the consumer.
And would the consumer have to notify Avvo in some way? I wasn't satisfied, or I didn't get the help that I wanted. He told me to come by the office.
And this is one where I know we've been testing out some different interfaces on how this works at that end. But there's basically something the consumer has to do. And this is where I'm not sure on the exact mechanics of it as of today. There's something the consumer has to do after the call to indicate that the call was successfully completed before the $39 gets charged.
Uh-huh. And so that's as between Avvo and the lawyer, if the call was considered not successful by the consumer, Avvo promises 100% money back, no questions asked. But who takes the hit on that then? Is it Avvo or is it the lawyer?
Avvo takes the hit on that. So in a case like that, the consumer doesn't get charged the $39 and the lawyer doesn't get charged their marketing fee.
But neither does the lawyer get the $29.
Right. I mean, the lawyer doesn't get the money either because no one's been charged the money.
I see. Okay. All right. So it's kind of a wash if it's not successful.
And right, I guess except presumably in that case, the lawyer's gotten the marketing lead.
Right. But you might have a complaint, I could imagine, from the lawyer saying, oh, this was a pain in the neck consumer. I gave him 15 minutes of bona fide legal advice. I expect my $29, you know, and then you're kind of in the middle between the client and the lawyer and that.
Oh, and you're asking about one where they actually give them 15 minutes of legal advice and the consumer asks for a refund.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, in a case like that, as it stands right now, we are, Avvo is simply eating that refund and the lawyer's getting their money.
I see. All right. So,
and that may be the case forever. I mean, we just don't know. I mean, one of the nice things I think that a lot of businesses have learned about unconditional guarantees is that they make it really easy for consumers to feel comfortable about trying a new service. Mm-hmm. But despite what particularly us lawyers may think about human nature, they're surprisingly infrequently exercised.
Right. Yeah. Well, it also, the way I sort of think about it when I go to Target, you know, it used to be, I felt like when I was a kid, it seemed like it was very hard to return something to a store, you know, and now it feels like it's very easy to return something to a store. And in a sense, that feels like a great a change in the way retail business is practiced, but it's, you know, the consumer's actually paying for that by a higher upfront fee. If it was harder to return something, then you might be paying a discounted price than you're otherwise paying. But maybe it's, you know, you're paying for a certain kind of insurance, you know, when you have an ease of returning something. And in some sense, that's got to be incorporated into the price of Avvo service as well. Maybe it's a little, I know you follow the point, but I'm not saying that you've actually worked out the particulars of that pricing, but it is involved in that no complaint guarantee. Let me ask you a couple other ethical questions that come up in connection with AVO service, and that is conflict checks, which are a big part of legal ethics. Before you take on a client, you're supposed to ensure that you don't have a conflict of interest, either your own interest conflicting with the client's or this prospective client's interest conflicting with a client's interest that you already have or a former client's interest that you have continuing loyalty obligations to. And those background checks, I think, typically are thought to take a good amount of time and might involve some review of records. So how are conflict checks handled? And I'll pitch a second question for timeliness purposes here. Do you have concerns about the lawyer-client privilege in AVO's intersection with the lawyer-client relationship in these communications?
Okay. So as for the conflict checks, I mean, it doesn't seem to be much of an issue, and I think there's a couple reasons for that. One is that a lot of these, the types of practice areas that are most amenable to advisor aren't really ones where conflicts are terribly important, or there are likely to be conflicts. And secondly, a lot of the lawyers who participate in advisor are solos or they're in small practices where their ability to check conflicts might just be more streamlined than in a larger organization. So, and people have a lot of different systems, but I mean, I've talked to lawyers who say, you know, yeah, I love the advisor service. I get it. I get the name. I can check my conflicts. I'm guessing they're just checking like a current and former client list on their phone, but they're just running a search. They don't get a hit. Good. They're off to the races, and that's the extent of their conflict checks. I've probably talked to a couple of lawyers over the last few months who've had concerns about how cumbersome it would be to run conflicts. But surprisingly, you know, for the rest of our participants, it just doesn't seem to be an issue. They're comfortable doing it the same way they would if they got an inbound unsolicited inquiry over the phone and someone wanted to start talking about their legal issues. You know, they'd know they'd need to check their conflicts fairly early in that discussion anyway, and it's something that they've got processes set up to do.
Yeah, if I can just reflect on that, it's not like you're getting a multinational corporation's general counsel calling up on AVO, where the multinational might have various subsidiaries and litigations going on in 17 different cities. You know, that would involve a kind of very exhaustive, professionally run, you know, conflict check. But that's not the kind of service that you're looking through AVO. And so there might be a little bit of a ship's passing in the night where ethicists or lawyers who are engaged in bar regulation are they're giving their genuine reaction to the conflict problem and kind of horrified at the 15-minute aspect, but they're just not connecting with the kind of legal service that is being provided, where another lawyer might say, yeah, I do my conflicts checks sitting behind my desk when I get the name of the person, and that might be perfectly reasonable way to do it. But then again, one might say that this is exposing, it's giving the acid bath of the markets test to the real legitimacy of some of the barriers to entry that the profession has traditionally erected around itself. And one of them might be a kind of fetishized approach to conflict checks, you know, that really is artificially onerous, that creates barriers to entry, and that makes legal services unnecessarily expensive and thus unavailable to poor people or to middle class people.
Yeah, I think that's right, and that's a lot of what went into our thinking behind Advisor was, how can we make this simpler, cheaper, and more predictable for consumers? Because the lack of predictability is a big problem about whether you can hire a particular lawyer and then what it's going to cost you. Mm-hmm. Just that, you know, the lack of transparency and the idea that you might get a bill out of the blue for several thousand dollars that you're completely unprepared to pay. I mean, that's a big impediment to people going and getting legal services.
Right. Now, how about the about attorney-client privilege? You mentioned, and I saw on the website, that you can upload a document that the lawyer can review. And my legal ethics flag went up to, I didn't have an answer to it, so I'm happy to be able to ask you and have the conversation that I worried if the client is sending through Avvo's technological platform here a document to a lawyer, that document is not covered by the attorney-client privilege. Is that right? Is that a concern? How do you manage that?
Yeah, I don't think it's a concern. We're not looking at the document. It's mm-hmm. simply being transmitted through our system. Mm-hmm. And it's not even stored on our system. I was actually talking with our product manager about this the other day because it's a new product for us, and I wanted the piece where you can transmit the document, and I wanted to make sure we had our I's dotted and T's crossed. I think it sort of self-destructs off our system after 30 or 60 minutes, but no one here is looking at it. So I think it's akin to any number of cloud-based services that lawyers would use to share documents with clients, which could run the gamut from Gmail to practice management platforms like Clio or Rocket Matter.
And have you heard other complaints or concerns about privilege issues with respect to the advisor service?
We have not. Now, again, the document thing is really new. That's only been out for a couple of weeks. But it strikes me as a non-issue, just given the fact that there's so much precedent for lawyers to interface with and share documents with clients using third-party services. I don't really see us. I mean, that's one area where I don't really see what we're doing being particularly innovative or envelope pushing.
And when you get when somebody signs up for the advisor service, a lawyer has to register through Avvo's website to become available in the advisor service. Do you do a vetting of those lawyers beyond seeing, oh, they're admitted to the bar and they're not suspended and therefore they're in? Or do they have to reach a certain level in Avvo's algorithm before they become in that advisor pool? Or is it, if you're admitted to the bar, you're in, if you're not, you're out?
It's a little bit in between those two. I mean, there's a pretty lightweight vetting, though. Mm-hmm. We have waiting lists of lawyers, frankly, in a lot of areas. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to just balance out supply and demand as we build this marketplace. Mm-hmm. But we will probably fine tune that vetting process as the product grows. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have any particular interest in, you know, limiting it only to highly rated lawyers. Mm-hmm. Obviously we want, The biggest thing we want is we want lawyers who can deliver a quality product to consumers. So I would guess that over time, the biggest vetting process is probably going to come out of the form of verified client feedback that we get out of the reviews after the advisor session.
How about you get $99 for a very highly ranked lawyer and like $15 for a lower ranked lawyer? Maybe one with... Okay, that's why I'm an academic and not a businessman.
I could easily see that happening. We've talked about differential pricing based on time of day. And you absolutely could have differential pricing based on how quickly you want a response.
Right.
And you could have differential pricing based on the rating or years of experience of the lawyer.
Right. So this is okay. So this is only the beginning, and I asked you for 45 minutes. We're well over that. So let me wrap up here by asking you, I guess, two questions. This is the beginning for Advisor. Where do you see the company, the service going, and the provision of this disruptive provision of legal services? Where is it going? What are the biggest business challenges that face that path? And what are the biggest legal or regulatory challenges that face that path?
Well, so if we're talking about the advisor product, I mean, we really believe that there's a marketplace for a lot of transparently priced legal services. Obviously not for every legal problem, but I sort of use the analogy to the fashion industry. It's like the way that the legal industry works right now, you've got two choices. You can either buy custom tailored clothing or you can make it yourself. And there's nothing that's off the rack. And so what we really want to do is we want to build that off the rack offering, that all that stuff in the middle between, you know, just going and finding the forms and muddling through them yourself, or go paying a lawyer to handle everything and maybe getting a bill for thousands of dollars that you weren't expecting. But somewhere in the middle, there are packaged legal services where you can say, okay, we have this well-defined legal problem that we're going to help you with, and there's a liquidated amount that you're going to pay for it, so you know exactly what you're getting. And our bet is that would be very empowering to consumers, because suddenly they wouldn't have to have the choice of simply doing it themselves, or paying God knows what to have a lawyer handle it on a fully bespoke basis. And so that's really where you'll see us adding additional products behind Advisor over the next year. Into different forms of packaged legal services like that are transparently priced. There's any number of business execution risks behind doing that, but I feel pretty confident that those are all things that our team has well in hand. From a regulatory perspective, I mean, there's no doubt, I mean, just based on the conversation we've had today, I mean, there's a lot of things we have to think about that maybe we wouldn't, you know, if we were in a different type of industry, because there is this whole history of lawyer advertising regulation and how you have to think about the various ways you structure the product, whether it's fee splitting or dealing with the conflict check. All of those are things that we have to think about as we roll out these new products. And we haven't heard from a lot of the bars on this. I don't know if, you know, as we get bigger, there's certainly a history as things have gotten disruptive. You do tend to hear from incumbents who want to make noises about how what you're doing is violating the legacy rules. But we're doing what we can to operate within those rules to the extent those rules make sense.
Well, Josh, it's a fascinating product, and I appreciate the candor with which you've had this conversation. And I hope that as those challenges, business or legal or regulatory, come up in the future, we can revisit this conversation and check back in with Ava.
Absolutely, David. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Okay, that's our conversation with Josh King on disruption of the provision of legal services. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's at David YOSIFON, at David Yosifon. And I tweet it out whenever we post a new episode in this podcast series. We're sponsored by the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics here at Santa Clara University, and we are grateful for their sponsorship. I've enjoyed saying disruption throughout the course of this particular podcast. Disruption and continuity. Some balance of those two. Some wise reconciliation of those two impulses. The progressives, the disruptors, insist that the present day, the future, is burdened by unwise, irrational, superstitious legacies of the past. The conservatives, those urging continuity, insist that there is wisdom, inarticulable wisdom perhaps, in the practices and structures of the past. Legacies of understanding that we cast off at our peril. It seems to me that the course of prudence involves, at the first, respecting the importance of both of these perspectives, the disrupting progressive, the precautionary conservative. The best of both promises human flourishing. The worst of each threatens calamity. Therefore, the ethical path must involve respect and caution towards each. But in what measure, in what order, in what proportion? Maybe next time on the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. Thanks for listening.